supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Or a growing facility in their town, that's up to them. If they don't, then I will not, as governor, force them to take one.
A total of 6 medical marijuana facilities could be set up under the law. So far, only one in Montclair has received local approval. In sports, the Sixers crushed the Wizards last night, 120-89. The two meet again in Washington this evening, the tip at 7. And the Flyers are on the road as well. They'll play the Predators at 8. This is WHYY.
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, perhaps you have seen the evidence with thine own eyes. The leaves of spring bulbs are popping up in many places across the country, many months ahead of time, worrying the owners of those bulbs about what's going to happen. We'll take a close look at what could have caused this and what you should or shouldn't do about it. But mostly it's a phone call show, cats and kittens, and you know what that means. We're going to take that heap and helping of your telecommunicating questions, comments, tips, tricks, etc. At 1-888-346-9499. Sarah, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Sarah. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, and thanks for taking my call.
Well, thanks for making it. Where is Sarah Good?
In Philadelphia.
Okay. Now, you know, because that's like London or Chicago, you have to delve further.
Chestnut Hill.
Chestnut Hill. Very good. A very nice neighborhood. What can we do for Sarah in Chestnut Hill?
Well, Mike, I was listening to your show. I think you had a guest on talking about not moving firewood.
Okay.
And I was thinking of sending my sister in Titusville, Pennsylvania, some Magnolia grandiflora to decorate her house. And I was wondering if I was putting the environment at risk by doing that.
You know, ever since we had that woman on from the Nature Conservancy, we're getting all these emails saying, what does this mean about taking plants across state lines? And many people wanted to know about the safety of moving Christmas trees from state to state. Now, you want to cut some branches from your magnolia and send them to your sister for her to use as decoration, not for her to try to propagate or anything.
No, to use as decoration.
Well, I know of no specific problems. Where's she going to show them, even?
Well, in her house and maybe in a spray on her front door. I'm not exactly sure.
It's not one of these plants that so far has been identified as being attacked by these wood-boring pests.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you're absolutely correct to wonder about it, and I think as we go forward, we're going to see a lot of thoughtful people wondering about the viability of sending plant material that they can't have inspected, you know, because when a nursery, a mail-order nursery, somebody who sends plants all around the country, they have these sanitation certificates that show that they've been inspected. So what I would tell you to do here is something that I rarely do, which is simply use common sense. You know, inspect the branches real carefully. Obviously, you wouldn't want to send them if you look at them and you see there's little holes in the branches themselves that some wood-boring insect has made. You're probably going to miss them anyway to keep them fresh during the trip. So I'd say this would be a great opportunity to, before you send them, take them inside, put them in a sink, put them in a bathtub, and spray them down real good. And the combination of those two things, it should absolutely be safe. And I will tell you, you are not on any kind of a list right now. The firewood is, there's all sorts of embargoes all around the country against taking firewood, sometimes as close as 50 miles. But so far, nobody's talking about this type of plant material. And I'd say you're even safer because it's something she's just going to display to brighten up the place at winter time and not try to propagate.
Yes, and I was thinking that it's at the sort of northern reach, you know, in terms of survivability in this climate, so that any of the common bugs probably are, since I never see any disease on this plant at all, most of the common ones probably just don't survive our winters.
Yeah, and that's a good sign, too. I mean, you're obviously proud of this plant. It looks nice. You wouldn't send your sister infested specimens. But, you know, once, you know, you start to think about somebody doing this with pine boughs, and all of a sudden you're in a very sticky situation.
That's right. That's right.
The world just keeps shrinking, doesn't it?
It does.
All right. Thank you, Sarah.
Well, thank you, Mike.
Take care.
Great. You too.
1-888-346-9499. Vince, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike. How are you doing?
I am doing really well. Vince, how are you, sir?
It's a little drippy here. We're in the second wettest year in Ohio history.
Wow. So what part of Ohio are you in?
South Solon. We're between Columbus and Dayton.
Okay, very good. Where I live, we had the wettest year in history. So, you know, no second-rate stuff down here, Vince. Boy, I'm telling you, I'm tired of the rain, too. All right, what can we do for Vince in Ohio?
All right, my brother told me, he was told of a technique for raising potatoes in what I'll call a tower. You take 1x12 lumber, build about a 2-foot by 2-foot frame, plant your potato, and as it grows, you keep adding levels, covering the vine, leaving about 6 inches out, and you get to about 4 to 5 feet tall. He said he did this, and last fall when he took his apart, they were entirely full of potatoes. I haven't tried this yet. I want to. But to build my tower, I've got a piece of that big black drain tile they use for field tile that I can cut into sections. And I'm wondering if it being black will suck up too much heat from the sun and harm my potatoes.
Oh, that's an interesting question. This technique goes back quite a ways. The first time I heard what you're talking about was somebody had an old Lehigh-style compost bin. This is a 4x4 foot wooden slatted compost bin. So, you know, you would have a slat of wood, then you'd have an equal size opening, then you'd have another slat of wood. So, and this is the preferred method for doing this, because what you do is you would shovel soil or compost into the Lehigh bin until you got to the first opening on the side of the slats. And then you would arrange some potatoes around the outside of the bin, pointing out towards the opening, with some of their eyes pointing out that way. Then you would cover them with a layer of soil till you got to the next open slat, and you'd do that till the thing was filled up to the top. And then the greenery, which is essential, would grow out of all the openings, and by mid-season, you can't see that there's a compost bin. It just looks like this giant kind of square-shaped plant material. But because of all the openings and all the greenery that was coming out and being exposed to the sunlight, it was actually a superior method of growing to in the ground. The plant could absorb more solar energy. So as you're describing, when the bin would be lifted off at the end of the season, it'd be wall-to-wall potatoes in the center because the tubers on the outside, they grew their greenery out, but their little potatoes, not little potatoes, big potatoes, they tended to grow towards the center where there was all that dark, moist soil. So that's one of the keys with any kind of potato tower, is you want to have a lot of openings because you don't get potatoes without the green growth. The green growth of the seed potato plant, that's your solar panel. That's your energy collector that's going to spur the growth of lots of tubers. So whatever design you use has to have a lot of openings on the sides for the potato plant greenery to come out.
Okay, so it doesn't sound like this material is going to be something good for me then. It doesn't have the openings in it.
Yeah, unless you want to notch out openings, you know, because again, you could fill your tube with soil up to a certain height, say a foot or two, and then you could notch out openings and push a seed potato inside, maybe do an opening on the other side, but, you know, just make the openings big enough that you'd still have structural integrity, and then you could continue that up to the top. And the greenery loves growing like this. And, Vince, I would think by the time we got to the real dog days, it wouldn't be black on the outside anymore. It would be covered with the green potato leaves, especially if you do a big planting at the very top. They would cascade down the sides like tomato vines.
Okay, yeah, I was worried because I got mostly direct sun. I don't have a lot of shade in the backyard, and I don't have a lot of space either. That's why I wanted to try and go up instead of out with them.
I think potatoes are one of the easiest things to grow upward. And that's, you know, everybody, the gardening trend today is people want to grow more of their own food, but they have less space to do it in. You know, so that's kind of the motto of the urban gardener is grow up. You know, trellis everything you can straight up. Make sure your tomatoes are in cages. You know, trellis your cucumbers, that kind of thing. But there's, you know, the potatoes, that this is kind of low-hanging fruit. They love growing like this. And I think all you'd have to do is just keep notching out those sides and just be careful you made your tower still, you know, supportable.
Okay. Would sweet potatoes work in a tower?
No. No, there's no relation between the two plants. Sweet potatoes grow entirely different than what are called Irish potatoes. They're not even vaguely related.
All right, Michael, thank you.
All right, Vince, good luck.
Okay, thank you.
Bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and warn all of our listeners in and around the Akron area that I will return to the land of wicked wind chill to appear at the Akron Home and Flower Show on Saturday and Sunday, February 25th and 26th. But don't you go marking your calendar or making plans to fly to Florida to escape me and the weather just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls and what you should and shouldn't do if your spring bulbs are breaking ground already. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
This is WHYY.
Penswood Village, a Quaker-directed active senior living community, supports WHYY. Situated on 82 acres in Bucks County, Penswood Village offers residential, health, and community services designed to meet the needs of people over 65. Amenities include garden apartment living, type A all-inclusive life care, and a newly renovated community building. A green community, Penswood welcomes applications for future residency. For details or a tour, 888-454-1122 or penswood.org.
WHYY programming is supported by the teachers and education support professionals of the Pennsylvania State Education Association, educating all children for a bright future. We are PSEA, providing the power of a great education.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, a lot of people have something unusual happening in their landscape. Their spring bulb leaves have broken ground way ahead of schedule. What does this spell for the springtime show? We'll tell you after a lot more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Denise, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Denise. How are you?
I'm very good. How are you?
I am fine, thank you. And where is Denise very good?
Northeast Philadelphia.
Okay, I know it well. What can we do for Denise in Northeast Philly?
Well, when I bought my home, it came with a very steep bank between the driveway and front walk that is covered in English ivy.
Okay.
It's right up against the house. It only gets about an hour of sun a day.
Mm-hmm.
And the bank is so steep, you would be insane to try to mow it. So I understand why there's ivy there. The problem is that the stuff grows so fast, and especially last summer when we had all that rain.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think it was threatening passersby.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Ivy will reach out if it's a small enough child.
Oh, yes.
Ivy will reach out a tendril.
And I actually found a child's toy in there one day.
That's right, that's right. And God bless the child. We can only hope that they manage to scurry away, but they try to stun them. The ivy tendrils pull them down, try to stun them, and then they pull them into the depth of the ivy.
I well believe it.
Where they're never heard from
again. I well believe it. So what I was looking for was an alternative. Is there something else I can plant there?
Well, the typical answer is Pacis sandra.
But that's pretty slow to get started, wouldn't
it? Well, see, nothing is as fast as ivy.
Well, yeah.
Nothing
true.
Is as invulnerable as ivy. It's been a while since we warned gardeners, but if you're looking in a catalog and you see easy grow, no care, that means it is going to try and take over the universe. You know, it will cost you three quarters of your soul to get it out.
The ivy?
To get the ivy
out.
Yeah. You know, because of its waxy coating, ivy is impervious to all herbicides, organic or chemical. Flame weeders really even have a difficult time dehydrating it. So by the time you were done, it would all have to be dug up
hand. I mean, it's a small enough area that's feasible. And I actually took out a strip about 12 inches wide right along the driveway to keep it from vandalizing my car.
Right.
And I've managed to keep that ivy free. So, I mean, it would be doable to take it out by hand, and that's what I would do.
Okay. So if you were to take it out by hand, my suggestion, with the caveat that picking plants is not my best thing. You know, I'm a problem solver. I'm a vegetable grower. I'm the expert in alternatives. But when I hear about situations like this, I think of a similar tough plant that is not as aggressive a grower. What I would do, if you're willing to pull it out, I would install some really beautiful low-growing juniper.
Okay.
Evergreen.
That'll take the shade. It's really shady there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I think you'll do fine. I would at least investigate some low-growing junipers. In my experience, they get by without a lot of light. And if you want other alternatives, you know, when we say ivy, we tend to take a gigantic plant family and just identify it by its most villainous cousin. If you go to our website, if you go to our Garden Answers A to Z and click on the letter I,
mm-hmm.
There is a description of a lot of other ivies that are a lot better behaved, but that are also very good at holding soil and getting by without a lot of sun. I tell you, if it were, if I had decided the ivy was going to go, because I especially like the look, I would try to replace it with low-growing junipers.
All right, well, I will look into that.
Inside of the low-growing junipers, there's beautiful forms, beautiful colors. Sometimes you get these wonderful little twisted tree trunks that you can see, you know, through the juniper itself. I think it's a very underutilized landscape plant. I'm thinking of something that's also going, you could install in a large manner that would shade the surface, that would help keep the ivy at bay, any regrowth at bay.
True. There will be, I mean, you have to go back and weed a few times before you get it all.
So I might be wrong, but my answer is low-growing juniper.
All right. Well, I will take a look then.
All right?
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Take care.
You too.
1-888-346-9499. Mixty, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello. Am I getting your name even close to correct?
It's actually pronounced Misty. I was named after a volcanic eruption in Peru.
Oh, okay. So because I'm looking on the screen and it says M-I-X-T-I.
Yeah, it's just pronounced Misty, but it's spelled that way.
And was that the name of the volcano?
Yeah, it's still there.
It's still there. And are you known to erupt and destroy villages?
Well, I don't think so, but I've been told otherwise.
You know, you're kind of setting a child up with certain expectations when you name them after an erupting volcano.
Yeah, I'm cursed with it.
And where is this volcano? Where is our local volcano here?
The great town of Notasulga, Alabama.
Oh, okay. Very good. What can we do for Misty in Alabama?
Well, I'm getting back to gardening after about 10 years, but I have raised bed frames, and I want to put them directly on the ground and lightly fork the ground and then try to make compost directly in the raised beds and have it ready for, say, summer.
Well, you're in Alabama, where you're going to have a relatively warm winter. Now, you're not in southern Florida. You're not in southern California. I see a couple of problems with what you want to do. First of all, why would it be so different to assemble your compost ingredients in a bigger pile where they'll heat up faster, have the ability to become more compost more quickly, and then fill the frames in the spring?
I could do that. I actually have a beautiful compost bin, and I'm making compost.
Excellent. And what are you making it out of?
I have tons of leaves, and then I have summer ground, some aren't.
Okay, well, you got to stop right there.
Uh-oh.
If you want to make compost, I mean, because we're talking making compost over the winter, right?
Right.
Even in Alabama, you know, the days are short, the nights are cold, organic material slows down. The two secrets for making compost quickly are to shred the materials into the smallest pieces possible, and then to make the pile as big as possible to achieve critical mass. I should have said three with adding the correct ingredients. But shredding the materials down to the smallest size to begin with is going to be essential if you're making compost on the clock. So you can't have any whole leaves in there. They will resist your tender mercies.
Well, I'm just getting over a knee replacement, and I'm having another one done, so it won't be until maybe midsummer at the earliest before I can garden again.
Before you can garden. Is there anybody around to help you to shred your leaves for you? Shredding your leaves isn't exactly like moving boulders. I mean, you know, it's...
No, there's nobody.
Okay, well, see if your PT will work it into your rehab of your knees. But the bigger the pile, the smaller the ingredients, the more quickly it's going to become compost. What are you mixing in with your leaves?
I get tons and tons of produce waste.
Right.
And also, to try to jumpstart it, I made a solution of blood meal and bone meal.
Oh, okay.
And watered that in.
Okay. The blood meal, which is a slaughterhouse byproduct, is very nitrogen-rich. That will jumpstart your compost. The bone meal will not jumpstart your compost, but it will add certain nutrients to it.
Right.
The way to do that without going out and buying anything is to introduce a lot of coffee grounds. I have to now warn you about the other kind of rookie mistake of composting, or those who come back to composting after a decade, in that you got to have a light hand with the produce waste. Because that produce waste, if it starts to overwhelm your leaves, is going to also slow the process down. That sounds like you might need a worm bin inside somewhere to help you use up some of that produce waste, and also to supply any additional fertilizer you'll need, because your summers, you can get a late start in Alabama. Your summers are really long.
And this is going to be more of a late summer winter garden anyway because of the orientation.
Right. How high are the frames going to be?
8 inches.
Oh, that's not bad. In that case, I was a little concerned about you forking up the soil because you would release weed seeds. You would uncover weed seeds and then rebury them and they would sprout. But if you put the frames down, loosen up the soil a little bit, and then cover that with 8 inches of compost, any weeds that fight their way through are going to be so pitiful, you will feel sorry for them. Just do everything with shredded leaves, and your plan sounds great. Although I would not encourage you to make the compost in the beds themselves. I would make the compost in one big cooking bulk and then use it to fill the frames when you're ready.
Okay.
But it sounds like a good plan, and welcome back to gardening.
Oh, it's great. I love it.
All right.
And I love your show.
Oh, thank you very much, and good luck with your new niece.
Thank you so much.
All right, you take care.
Thanks, you too. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. James, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike, how you doing?
I am doing well today, James. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great, Mike.
And where is James doing great?
I'm in Galway Township, New Jersey, about 10 miles east of Atlantic City.
10 miles east of Atlantic City. That would put you out in the ocean, wouldn't
it? Yep, I guess I'm west of Atlantic City then.
Yeah, I was going to say, 10 miles.
Sometimes I'm east out there fishing.
Yeah, 10 miles east of Atlantic City. That's chilly right now. All right, James in Galloway Township, New Jersey, who can get to the boardwalk pretty quickly. What can we do for you, sir?
Yeah, it's a little problem. Last year, all of a sudden in our garden, we have pine trees and wood mulch around our house. These mushrooms started showing up. They have an odor to them. They draw flies, and they're quite a nuisance. And I was wondering, how do I get rid of them, and where did they come from?
They came from your wood mulch, James. There are many types of what are called nuisance fungi. And I guess it was about 20 years ago, landfills stopped accepting wood waste. And that's when this ridiculous trend of, quote, decorative mulching started, with people being sold a bill of goods on shredded bark, on wood chips, on that terrible dyed stuff, those chipped up pallets from China that are spray painted some god awful color never seen in nature. And these wood mulches are a terrible idea, especially they're plant killers if they're allowed to touch plants. If they work into the soil, they'll make the soil unbearable for plants for years to come. But if they're just used as a mulch, they have three or four big fungi problems that pop up. Some of which, now, yours are very interesting, and they are very annoying and embarrassing. A term for what you have is the stinkhorn fungus. As you can see, it is in the form of a quote-unquote horn, and if you kick the horn out of frustration, you'll find where they got the stink name from. And that stink does attract flies who think that there's, you know, like a dead animal around. There is no way that you can have dead wood on our planet and not have fungi and mycelium and all of those members of the world of the gray seek it out to help it return to the soil. That's one of the big jobs of mushrooms and fungi, in our environment is to break down wood so that it becomes rich, fertile soil again. They're just doing their job. But the good news is that that mulch is trash. It's no good for you. It's no good for your home. It's no good for your plants. Rake up that mulch. Move it into a corner where it's not near anything, and it will decompose, and it'll become compost in a couple of years.
Well, just a question. I've had this mulch for about 10 years. You know, I've had different kinds of fungus and stuff out there and mushrooms, but just these particular kind showed up last year. Is there any reason why they didn't show up, you know, 8 or 9 years ago?
All of the most common ones are ubiquitous. Their spores are in the air all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And where they land is a function of wind and temperature. And then the humidity in the air and the wetness of the wood and the age of the mulch will all lead to different spores being fruitful, so to speak.
Right.
But if you have wood mulch outside your house for 20 years, over that 20 years, you're going to see all of them at least once.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the advice, and I sure will get rid of that mulch.
Good luck, James.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody who doesn't have land of their own, but who still wants to eat fresh, local, and organic, that now is the time to seek out your local CSA. Short for Community Supported Agriculture, CSAs are local farms in which you buy a share for the season and get a share of the enviable edibles that the farm produces once a week. And the first of that produce will be produced surprisingly soon. But don't you go looking through the lists of CSAs at our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and what to do if your spring bulbs are trying to show themselves while it's still winter. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
It's 11:38. You're listening to WHYY.
Mike McGrath, right back at you with local events. The Longwood Gardens Professional Gardener Alumni Association will present the 2012 Today's Horticulture Symposium on Friday, February 3rd at Longwood Gardens in Kennett Square, PA. Topics include green roofs, rain gardens, and containers for all seasons. The Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture will hold their 21st Annual Farming for the Future Conference, February 1st to the 4th, at the Penn Stater Conference Center in State College, PA. And I'll open my speaking season with appearances at noon and 2 p.m. at the Grounds for Sculpture Park in Hamilton, New Jersey on Sunday, February 5th. We'll post all the details at the events section of our website, youbetyourgarden.org.
We invite you to join us for a fresh air weekend at 1 today for the story of Rin Tin Tin, a dog who was found in the wreckage of a kennel during World War I and then went on to become a huge radio, TV, and film star. And then an interview with actor Gary Oldman. Fresh air at 1 today on WHYY.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. What should you do when your spring bulbs break ground in the fall? Are the flowers threatened? Will we get a show in the spring? We'll let you know all the details after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Pat, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you very much. How are you today?
I am doing well, Pat. How are you, sir?
I'm doing fantastic.
And where is Pat Fantastic?
I am in Dayton, Ohio.
All right. Very good, sir. What can we do you for?
Well, I have a small garden in my backyard. It's about 30 feet by 20 feet. And I'm also a personal chef. So
okay.
I take a lot of the vegetables that I grow in my garden and I give to my clients just because we have a lot of personal relationships with them. It's just the nature of what we do. So I've stolen as many bags of leaves as I could find. I've got friends that raise cattle, so I've got all kinds of well-aged cow manure on it. But I am in the process of, well, now that it snowed, I was planning on cutting my grass. And I wanted to know if it was okay for me to put my grass clippings onto my garden, even though it's been treated by a local company?
Absolutely not. Absolutely
wow.
not. The herbicides that are allowed for use on lawns today are so deadly to other plants and so persistent that the compost made from yard waste that incorporated grass clippings from treated lawns has been shown to kill seedlings even
wow.
after the grass was completely composted. And I'm sorry to hear that you're treating your lawn, because that's a sham. There's no reason to spread any kind of chemicals on your lawn. And if the garden is right next to the lawn, you're making the garden non-organic by having a treated lawn right next to it.
What well, that's good to know.
What can we do to get you off the cycle of death here, pal?
Well, you tell me. I'm willing to do whatever it takes. I love my garden. I love my customers. And God help me if I'm poisoning them. So what do I need to do?
Well, you're in Dayton, Ohio.
Yes, sir.
So you, by definition, have a cool season grass. You either have bluegrass, rye, fescue, or a combination.
So fescue.
Right?
We have a fescue, yeah.
Okay. You want to have 10 to 20 pounds of corn gluten meal per 1,000 square feet of your turf on hand and ready to spread when you see the first blooms on the forsythia or red buds.
But oh, very good.
That will give your lawn a spring feeding. It will prevent any crabgrass seeds that you have out there from sprouting, give you a crabgrass-free start. It'll also give your lawn the perfect springtime feeding. Then, who cuts your lawn?
I do.
Okay. I think you either need a new lawnmower or you need to have your lawnmower retrofitted to become a mulching mower. This is a mower with a sealed deck and a super sharp blade that turns really fast. So
okay.
when you cut your lawn at 3 inches, it takes those grass clippings, suspends them inside the deck, cuts and recuts them hundreds, maybe thousands of times. So what falls back on your lawn is not wet, messy clippings, but a pulverized powder that's 10% nitrogen by weight. So every time you cut your lawn, you give your lawn a gentle feeding. And then in the fall, once the weather starts cooling off, like around September, that's when you want to take all that manure, that composted manure you have access to, get it out of the garden and spread it on your lawn.
Okay.
And then I would rather you feed and mulch your vegetable garden with mostly shredded fall leaves. You say you have the ability to collect a lot of leaves.
Yes, sir.
Make sure they get shredded up real well. Pile them up. You're a chef, so you're involved with the food community. I bet you have access to as many coffee grounds as you could possibly want.
And then some.
Mix coffee grounds in with your shredded leaves. That's the compost you want to be putting on your garden. The manure is better for your lawn. Compost made with shredded leaves and coffee grounds will be the ultimate food source for your garden.
Very good. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it, Mike.
All right. My pleasure. And you keep cooking, Pat.
Will do. You have a great day, sir. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Yeti, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, it's nice to have you here. And am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Yes, you are.
And where are we talking to you?
Kennett Square, Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay. Yes. A very beautiful area. That's where Longwood Gardens is located.
Exactly.
All right. What can we do for Yeti and Kennett Square?
Well, I love geranium, and I have quite a few in my garden and in pots hanging up. Now, I would like to have them over winter because they're so generous and so beautiful and so really giving all the time that they, if you want, just brings them in, they just sort of die eventually. So what I've done is cut them back about 2 inches from the ground and put them in a pot, in pots, and put them in a dark, cool closet.
Okay.
And with the hope that in the spring I can bring them out again. Is that the right procedure?
It's not the worst thing you could have done. It's
yes.
It's not the worst at all. And you got them in before we had a lot of hard frosts?
Yes.
Okay. Now, the dark, cool closet.
Yes.
Where in the house is this closet?
It's on a sun porch that's not heated.
Oh, okay. Do you have any idea what the temperature in there is?
Not really. But I know going in and out that it's not freezing. It's cold, but not freezing.
Okay. And you don't keep plants out there year-round?
No, this is the first time I'm doing it. That's why I'm calling you.
Right. And they are inside a closet on this porch.
Yes, they're planted on planters, and they're inside, and they're cut back.
Okay. Okay. I don't, you know, I think you're going to get some of them back, at least.
Okay.
You might get all of them back. Overwintering geraniums. Geraniums are like probably the first outdoor plant that American gardeners really started to experiment with bringing indoors for the winter.
Okay.
So I can tell you that virtually every technique has been tried. Ideally, what you would do is you would pot the plants up that weren't in pots or bring the pots inside in like September and put them in a very cool, dark place that doesn't freeze and that stays like the same temperature. Some people have basements or garages where there's so much junk in the garage, there's not a prayer of getting a car in and out of there.
Yeah.
So they just use it for storage and maybe water the plants once over the winter. You don't want to be watering your plants a lot. You don't want the soil to stay moist because then the roots would rot.
Okay.
So, and certainly you're not feeding a plant that you're trying to keep in dormancy. So your goal here is to keep their temperature as stable as possible. Don't let it go up and down. If you feel that you should water them, literally just one light watering halfway through the middle of winter.
About February.
Yeah, sometime around there.
Okay.
But I tell you, if you go and check them and the pots still feel heavy, like there's still moisture in them, then don't water them at all.
All right.
And then when the weather warms up, just take them outside and just take them outside for a couple of hours the first day. Bring them back inside and then harden them off by doing that for longer periods of time for like a week until finally at the end of the week, it's going to be a nice night. You leave them out. Then you let the then you give them a good watering, and we'll see what happens with the regrowth. But you know, I don't think anybody would be surprised if you got virtually every one of them to grow again.
Well, thank you very much. Now, when I take them out, I'm not going to take them outdoors. I'll still have them in the sun porch.
Oh, I see. That's absolutely fine.
Thank you very, very much.
Okay. Good luck.
That's very good. Thank you.
All right, give us a call back. Tell us how you did.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. Spring bulbs poking up in wintertime. Laura in Quakertown, Pennsylvania writes, "In November, I planted iris bulbs and covered the ground with mulch as directed on the package. It is now the end of December and the irises have sprouted up about 2-3 inches above the mulch. Will this be a problem for the bulbs? I wasn't sure if a really cold spell would damage them now that they're sprouting. I'm fairly new to bulbs, but I planted giant alliums last year and they didn't begin sprouting until the spring." Judy in Cincinnati adds, "We were away for the month of November, so we got our spring bulbs in the last week of October. Tulips, daffodils, hyacinth, crocus, grape hyacinth. Some of them have leaves up now. And my understanding is that these plants won't bloom this coming spring, except maybe the grape hyacinth. Will they bloom the next spring, 2013? I plan to leave them alone, cut off the leaves after they die, not water so the bulbs don't rot, and then keep them mulched with yard waste compost made of shredded leaves over the summer. I'd appreciate any suggestions you might have to improve their odds. And Jay in Bucks County writes, in late November, I noticed my daffodils coming up. By last week, they were about 4 inches above the soil. My friends have told me similar stories about other spring blooming bulbs. Should I be concerned about this? Will it affect their blooming in the spring? I'm inclined to just let nature take its course, but they are my favorite flower, and I want to make sure they're as beautiful as ever in a few months. Well, yes, spring is busting out all over, or at least it was last month. We received a record number of questions, concerns, and expressions of outright panic between Thanksgiving and Christmas over the sight of spring bulb leaves appearing above ground. And I personally have seen the phenomena occurring all over the Philadelphia area, especially in the heat sink of the city. Now, as we have mentioned previously on this show, it is perfectly normal for the skinny, floppy, completely unattractive octopus-like, quote, leaves of grape hyacinth to pop up in the fall and lay prostrate on the ground in their non-glory all winter until the flowers finally brighten up the show in the spring. But it is unnatural for other spring bulbs to send up their shoots before the new year. So we decided to consult with somebody who routinely tricks spring bulbs into doing things they normally would not. Art Walk, two-time Grand Sweepstakes bulb-forcing champion at the Philadelphia Flower Show and author of the brand new book, Bulb Forcing for Beginners and the Seriously Smitten. Yes, it's crazy out there right now, agrees Art, who postulates that the sustained cold spell much of the East Coast experienced in October caused lots of spring bulbs to behave almost like they were being forced. A really cold month early in the season, followed by a very warm stretch, can trigger flower stem extension a month ahead of the normal time, he explains, which is a lot like what he does deliberately and artificially to get bulbs to bloom ahead of schedule for the flower show. So what's going to happen? Are spring bulbs that normally bloom in April going to bloom in March? Or will winter storms kill the flowers outright? It's all good news, reports Art. First, there's a lot of antifreeze in these plants. So like the grape hyacinth, they can survive just fine with their leaves above ground over winter. And more importantly, flower stem development occurs independently of the leaves. Those little iris reticulata your first listener is worried about need 7 to 9 weeks of temperatures in the 38 to 50 degree Fahrenheit range to begin extending their flowering stem towards the surface, he explains, no matter what the leaves are doing. But that's not a very long time, I note. Don't some tulips need twice that long? Absolutely, replies Art, reminding me that those little irises always bloom very early in the spring. Most of the bulbs he forces for the flower show, like daffodils and tulips, need at least 10 weeks of cold temperatures before they shoot that flower stem up. And the bulbs that bloom the latest in nature, like those big ornamental alliums, take even longer. Now, we shouldn't underestimate what a crazy climate change season this has been, he continues. My friend Ellen Spector Platt sent me a picture of snowdrops in full bloom in New York's Central Park in mid-December, which seems crazy. But because snowdrops are among the very earliest of spring bulbs to bloom, always blooming really in the winter, it really just means that they were 4 to 6 weeks ahead of normal. So tell everyone who has greenery up already not to worry, assures Art. And tell them not to do anything to try and help the bulbs. They may bloom a month earlier than usual, Or they may bloom pretty much on schedule if it takes the soil an especially long time to warm up in the spring. But they should bloom just fine. The leaves are tough and the flowers are still safe inside the bulbs. Art continues, just warn people especially not to cover them with a lot of any kind of mulch to try and protect them. They don't need any help, and I've seen frozen mulch do a lot more damage to emerging flowers than weird weather ever could. Well, that sure was some reassuring advice about your prematurely sprouting spring bulbs now, wasn't it? Luckily for yous, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To carefully review this week's edition, just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes, my producer is threatening to cover me with frozen mulch if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live. Please put the actual subject in the subject line. And please check first to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week. Find the solution to hundreds of garden problems, hint, hint, just like yours, hint, hint, in our Garden Answers A to Z section. And or listen to this show, listen to old shows, and or download this week's podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Kevin Griffin. Our webmasters are Baneful Rich Banowitz and Sarah the She-Devil Kazar. The always early Alexis Landis produces and co-edits You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our production assistant, Amanda No Relation McGrath, is always on time. Hey, what's a couple of minutes here and there? Asks our editor, Al Banks. I'm late-blooming Mike McGrath, and I'll see you next week. If I'm not here, just start without me. I'm bound to show up sooner or later. Unless I can't find a place to park, or, you know, if I notice something shiny and bright in the distance, or... Is it a deadly menace? A natural mole repellent? An attractive tropical? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll take a close look at the notorious castor bean plant, plus your fabulous phone calls.
In a pickle with problematic plants, Mike's opinion can help you proliferate a paradise of parsley, peas, pansies, and more. Join us for You Bet Your Garden.